You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Friday, November 20th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It's Casual Friday, folks. Capping off perhaps one of the most bizarre and in many respects disturbing weeks we've had in years. On the program today, Cliff Schechter will join us to look back on this week and then hopefully to raise our spirits. Isabel Gillies will be here to recommend a movie ostensibly for me to stream over the weekend. These days, it just ends up being whatever my kids want to watch, but hopefully I'll be able to fend them off. Also on the program today, Hillary Clinton giving a major foreign policy speech yesterday. Bernie Sanders giving a major speech on his identification as a democratic socialist, as well as presenting foreign policy positions in light of the terrorist attack in France. Meanwhile, 27 people killed on an ongoing terrorist attack in Mali by radical jihadists. 6 people, I believe, dead in Israel on other attacks. Meanwhile, in this country, Republicans and 47 Democrats wage an assault on some of the primary American values in passing a bill in the House which will make it virtually impossible for us to accept refugees from this conflict in Syria, which was in many respects, if not predicated upon, certainly enhanced by our invasion of Iraq. And while more Mexicans are leaving this country than entering this country, which suggests that perhaps that wall Donald Trump wants to build may actually just keep undocumented immigrants in rather than out. Speaking of Donald Trump, he wants to form a national database of all Muslims. No word yet on what color the star will be on their armbands. Ted Cruz, fortunately, forming a national prayer team. So we have somewhere to turn, ladies and gentlemen. And obviously, we've got more. There is a new report out by, do I have this right? By Liberty Patriots. Is that who put out this report?
I believe so.
Liberty News Now.
Liberty News Now, not
Liberty News
Patriots.
Now,
excuse me.
On the 28 things to buy before Obama bans them. We will go down that as a public service.
You think you're going to be able to keep them?
What's that?
The things I'm going to ban?
Oh, in other words, even if we buy them now, you're going to get them back from us.
Fruit of Islam. That's all I can tell you. More on that later.
But you're not suggesting the fruit of Islam will be banned. You'll be able to get all the Islamic fruit that you want to be able to get.
The fruit of Islam is a secret security force that's going to take away the aforementioned items, which we'll get to later.
Yeah, let me just give you a taste of what those are, just so that if I, you know, one of the things that I think is really important with a podcast is and any type of radio show is that there are takeaways. In other words, that you have something that you learned that you didn't know before. And so number 17, Barbie dolls. Barbie dolls will be banned.
And I'll tell you exactly why. It celebrates the body of the infidel woman. They're often white. You know how I feel about white people in general, and you know how I feel about white people in particular. Here, the thing is that if you embrace Islam, the poison of the white race can be removed from you. But without the guidance of the Islamic faith, you are nothing other than a retrograde half-human.
All right.
Well, which is how I felt about white people for a long time. So Barbie doll's gone. Next.
Barbie doll. We will get to other lists later. Mm-hmm. Also, we're just going to play this as sort of just to capture the insanity that's going on right now. And Cliff and I will talk about, I'm sure we'll get to the fact that, you know, as ridiculous as Donald Trump is, Donald Trump, understand that he is now leading in the Republican polls. And not just now, his lead has expanded, as insane as he's been. Now, what can sum that up? Well, here is Pat Robertson speaking on the 700 Club. Maybe this is illustrative of the insanity that's going on. Pat Robertson.
Our viewers, this is Heather, who says, with the horrible ongoing ISIS attacks, I was wondering what you think Jesus would say about letting Syrian refugees into America. Is it more important to protect our country from evil or to try to reach out and save those who do not know him?
By nature, I am compassionate. And if I see a family that is fleeing oppression, I would say, let's put our arms around them and help them. That's my own personal. But from a policy standpoint, the truth is, these evil people have infiltrated the refugee hordes, and like one of them up in Paris was a man who had come in through the Macedonian corridor up into Europe, and he was, I guess, Syrian. I don't know what he was, but nevertheless, he was one of those refugees, and he brought mayhem. So I do think a country's got to be vigilant, but my heart, you ask me, my heart is to help the poor. And if I saw a family that's fleeing the oppression and the war in Syria, I would open my heart and say, let's take them in. But policymakers may disagree.
So there you have it. The wonderful mixture between knowing not at all what he's talking about, Pat Robertson. We know that one of those people was not a refugee. But he says, like, he came up through the Macedonian corridor, which I think for most listeners of the 700 Club probably just basically says, oh, he must know what he's talking about. I don't even know what the Macedonian corridor is. I didn't even know there was a corridor in Macedonia. And so that must be true. And then also, you get your cake and eat it, too, when you're one of these right-wingers, because my heart bleeds for these people. But from a policy standpoint, these hordes are infected, and we're going to have to cleanse them. So it's a dilemma, but at the end of the day, we should send them all to camps. That's basically, I think, what Pat Robertson's saying. And it really does capture the insanity, the fascism, the xenophobia, the lies of this moment that we're living in. And in many respects, I mean, it's not a replay, as we were talking about with Janine yesterday on the program. It's not a replay of what we saw in 2001, but it stinks of it quite a bit. We got to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Cliff Schechter. And just a reminder, folks, this program relies on you to support it. Our members make the free show possible, and we can't do it without you. And as a bonus, we give you an extra 40 or 50 minutes of content a day. Sometimes more than that, often more than that, sadly more than that. We try and control ourselves. We can't. So if you have the financial means to become a member, please do. If you do not and you want access to the fun half of the program, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We always will work out a deal with people because we don't want to lock anybody out for financial reasons. But it means that we need those people who can afford it and do enjoy the program, whether maybe it's once a week, maybe it's five times a week, to support us. So become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. And don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Great time to buy coffee and give it as a gift. Give the Majority Report blend. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Cliff Schechter. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. On the phone, it is the guy who inspired this little ditty.
Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC, New Media, Public Relations, and Strategy. You want any of these services, you know who you gotta see.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is Cliff Schechter. Hello, Cliff. How are you?
I am doing well. How are you, Sam?
I'm doing all right. You're calling where we've got you, and you're in the nation's capital today. Is that right?
I am in our lovely nation's capital, exactly. Doing some work, meeting with some people. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. No, we expect no less from you, Cliff. Now, been a an insane week. I mean, this sort of these sort of parallel stories that are going along where you see the these terror attacks a week ago, I guess a week ago today, actually,
yeah.
In Paris, and then followed up by a Democratic debate where in Iowa, which was really buried by the Democratic National Committee. They did a great job of burying it. It was a Saturday night. It was in Iowa on the night of a huge Iowa football game. My understanding is that football is rather big in that state. And
in certain parts of the country, they like that thing.
And then we had the subsequent some very great statements, I think, a couple of particularly great statements by President Obama, credit where credit is due in terms of keeping the lid or attempting to keep the lid on the anti-Muslim rhetoric that is building up on the right. And by,
of course, don't forget the wimpiness of 47 Democrats.
Yes. And also, let's add into that 48, when Chuck Schumer, although he sort of backed off that because the Senate rallied around this a little bit, or it tends to. But Chuck Schumer, the presumptive leader of the Democrats in the Senate, gives a little space, gives a little oxygen to all those Democrats who wanted to vote to basically, and we're make no mistake about it. I mean, people can talk about the intricacies of this, but when you pass a bill that says that the head of the CIA and the head of the DA, Department of Homeland Security have to personally certify every single refugee that comes in as not being a potential terrorist, you have effectively said, we're not going to accept any Syrian refugees into this country, basically increasing the chances that, you know, some of those people are going to die. And, yeah.
And you're making your attempt to if indeed it were to pass to, you know, and I mean, obviously Obama will veto it, were to pass over that, you're making your attempt to be remembered along with all the various other terrible moments in our nation's history.
Yes.
You're making a bid for Japanese internment camp kind of memories, Red Scare, you know, and kind of 1920s Palmer raids, kind of way back when. You're going for McCarthyism. I mean, you know, this is the company that you're trying to be held in esteem with. So, way to go.
Well, yeah, I mean, you've got a mayor from Roanoke, Virginia, who actually writes a letter, a Democrat, who writes a letter citing Japanese internment camps as a positive thing and as the basis of why we should reject these refugees. Now, let me just say this, okay? The reason why...
Did you write that letter in crayon, or was it...
Well, but here's the thing. I mean, I don't know if that's just like... I mean, our government has officially apologized for this. I mean, there should be no doubt that this is a stain on the country's history. But apparently, there is...
Also, but he didn't get that memo.
Right, right. I mean, but you know, people sometimes tweet at me or write into the show and say, like, you know, why do you spend so much time on this moron who is irrelevant, who's trying to make some type of intellectual case that there's something inherently wrong with Muslims, or why do you or with Islam, or why do you take the time to refute when Michelle Malkin comes out with a book praising Japanese internment? Well, this is why, because there's such
it moves the Overton window of what of the bad things that can be done on the other side. In other words, I don't mean to speak for you, Sam, but I guess I cut you off, so maybe I should.
No, but just you're that's
in 2 seconds. I'll just say, you know, I this is how I break it down. I don't bother with every moron who calls me a name on Twitter or somewhere else. I find a lot of that stuff kind of funny, and if I do respond, it's usually to challenge them to do better because I'm not impressed. But when it's somebody who has the kind of following that Michelle Malkin has. Or even you hear people saying, oh, ignore what Trump says. Yes, the guy that all media is paying attention to, just ignore. You can't, because if you don't refute what people say that are getting a lot of attention, that becomes mainstreamed.
Yes.
And we're already at a point now where they've mainstreamed saying certain things that were considered to be radical to say even under the Bush administration, the second one.
Yeah, I mean, look, I can tell you just, you know, on this, I mean, what we're seeing, you know, where you have the front runner of the Republican Party, and you know, this guy is the legitimate front runner now, right? You know, like all the data journalists who wanted to tell us 3 months ago, like, Trump's not in the lead, he doesn't have the endorsements of the major political
term.
Right, exactly. Even those people have now quieted themselves, and the fact of the matter is, you have this guy is in the lead, his lead is growing each and every day, and he is now calling for a database of Muslims in this country. And so if anybody out there thinks that laying the intellectual groundwork to say that there's something intrinsically wrong with Islam, and we're seeing these arguments now cropping up in places like Salon.com. I mean, this is how these ideas spread. This is what the danger of letting these ideas just sort of fester out there, because then one day something happens, and all of a sudden these things are just sort of picked up and mainstreamed. And so it's disgusting.
This is the history, the story of you know, how society has become totalitarian and fascist, you know, or you know, since the dawn of time. You know what I mean? I mean, the problem, people always jump quickly to the sort of Nazi analogy, and then everybody just gets lost in Nazism and blah, blah, blah. So don't even, you know, stay away from that. But, you know, take a look at other societies. Take a look at Italy, you know, in leading up to Mussolini. Take a look at various countries in Asia and when they overthrew at least semi-democratic governments to suddenly embrace totalitarianism. I mean, the story is always the same. When people start doing this and pushing the envelope and scapegoating and talking about rounding people up or at least monitoring people, everybody immediately, you know, sort of says, oh, you know, they're just talking. But the point is they provide a justification for the people who are crazier out there, and they start mainstreaming ideas that previously were considered nuts.
Well, I mean, but let's look at this even more practically. I mean, and yes, Godwin's law, we don't raise Nazis, but let's just talk about Jewish refugees who were sent back in the 1930s back to Germany because there was a fear that there could be Nazis embedded in them and they could attack us from within. I mean, I don't know how you get a more sort of, perfect analogy here. But on top of that, you know, we can talk about President Obama vetoing this, but the fact is that it just passed in the House with a veto-proof majority. And
right.
Now it's going to stop. And it's going to stop
Does that in the Senate, but it's more the cultural change it brings about than the fact that it passes.
Right. Well, I mean, look, Harry Reid has basically said, this is not going to get a vote in the Senate. And I believe Harry Reid when he says that. But let's just go ahead, shoot ahead 3 years from now when Chuck Schumer, whose first reaction was to immediately say, we got to take another look at this. I mean, this is Chuck Schumer, the guy who's going to be leading the Senate, Senate. And, you know, so the idea that we're sort of like in this neighborhood is not so far-fetched. It's not simply that Obama could veto this. You know, with President Clinton, let's say, and with Chuck Schumer in this very scenario, it remains to be seen where we end up with something like this. And now, of course, look, 10,000, we've let in something like 1,900 Syrian refugees at this point. We're not going to get anywhere close, or I should say we're on 1,900 over years. If we keep up the pace that we have this year, we're not even going to let in 2,000. So, I mean, in some respects, it's academic, unless, of course, you're one of these families who's been for 2 or 3 years trying to land in a home somewhere. But this is scary, scary stuff. And it's much, I think, easier for the American population to sort of avoid how scary this is because we've done such a great job in this country of otherizing Muslims in some way. And, you know, there seems to be this sort of muscle memory for panic and hysteria around these issues. I mean, let's remember here, you know, what happened in Paris are horrible. And the idea that you could have multiple attacks at the same time certainly can make you feel like you are unsafe. But, you know, person for person, in terms of the actual existential threat, we're not talking about an existential threat here.
No. Was that a question from me?
No, it was just me just sort of like realizing I should take a breath and let you have a word in edgewise.
No, man, I'm enjoying listening to you. Keep going. Preach on, well, my brother.
All right. Well, before we get to any sort of the specific stories, let's go into the speech that that Bernie and Hillary both made this week. And Clinton's, you know, I don't know. I mean, I wanted to get your take on it, but from a foreign policy standpoint, I think Clinton very much tried to align herself with what Obama has been doing with the Obama project. I don't know if there was anything that was anything to the extent that there were any differences. I think a lot of people were aware of those because, you know, they've made a point of sort of saying she would have, armed Syrian rebels or gotten into the Syrian conflict earlier. She was one of the people who advocated for the Libya intervention. And I think that, you know, she basically expressed those ideas. One part that I did like, this is we were talking about this sort of demonization of of Muslims and Islam. Hillary Clinton had this to say, which, you know, put aside sort of any of the other myriad of reasons why this demonization is illegitimate. She just basically talked about how impractical and unproductive it is. This is Hillary Clinton at the Council for Foreign Relations earlier this week. Clip number 5.
Online or offline, the bottom line is that we are in a contest of ideas against an ideology of hate, and we have to win. Let's be clear, though. Islam is not our adversary. Muslims are peaceful and tolerant people and have nothing whatsoever to do with terrorism. The obsession in some quarters with a clash of civilization or repeating the specific words radical Islamic terrorism isn't just a distraction. It gives these criminals, these murderers, more standing than they deserve. It actually plays into their hands by alienating partners we need by our side. Our priority should be how to fight the enemy. In the end, it didn't matter what kind of terrorist we called bin Laden. It mattered that we killed bin Laden. But we still can't close our eyes to the fact that there is a distorted and dangerous stream of extremism within the Muslim world that continues to spread. Its adherents are relatively few in number, but capable of causing profound damage, most especially to their own communities, throughout an arc of instability that stretches from North and West Africa to Asia.
So, Cliff, you could hear that, right?
Yes, I could.
Okay. And so, you know, that is, you know, particularly at times like this, I have been very encouraged to hear something like that from Clinton. And also, you know, we heard some very strong responses from President Obama this week along that same lines. And you know, sort of consistent with what we were saying before about why you got to tamp down ideas like Japanese internment was a good thing. These ideas you need to tamp down quickly because when you start to see this type of stuff brewing here, what it leads to 6 months, 8 months, a year, 2 years, 3 years down the road is we're involved in some other type of invasion.
Well, yeah, either that or we're involved in some kind of repression at home.
Right.
That we end up taking us somewhere that we never thought we would go. And again, you know, I people sort of who were politically active, old enough to be politically active in the 90s, you know, I would say that somebody growing up then, and you and I are of similar age, Sam, I mean, you read about Watergate and the Vietnam era and these things. They were history to me. And the 90s, at least at the time, seemed like a pretty peaceful and prosperous time, with some exceptions, certainly. But, you know, the thought then, if you had asked me, maybe I'm more naive than you, if the United States would torture people and then justify that, I would have said absolutely not. We would never do that. You know, I mean, I wouldn't say that, you know, some CIA guy going rogue somewhere wouldn't do this or do that. But I would never have thought that that would actually be our government policy laid out in memos and justified. But the slippery slope gets you there. You know, certain justifications and certain war acts and other things get you there. So that the whole point here is not, you know, it's that once you step, you know, a little bit further along the line, a little bit further, you know, it's the old sort of, you know, thing about the frog boiling in a pot. Before you know it, you're somewhere that you can't believe you are, and you don't know how you really got there. And you're doing things like that. And so, yeah, whether it's foreign invasions, I mean, I'm glad Hillary Clinton said what she said, certainly about, you know, certainly the rhetoric on Muslims, on you know, talking about all of us being people, and Muslims, you know, are no different. There's radical groups of every group out there, and I think that's important and helpful. I would say, you know, her agreeing with President Obama on all this stuff, because I think on foreign policy he's mostly gotten it right. But, you know, the whole thing about arming Syrians still bothers me.
Right.
You know, who would we have been arming? You know, I mean, that's the whole problem is that when we waste our time arming people and then those arms are used against us, you know, in a year or two span there, or less, really, 6 months. We, you know, one moment where the argument was we have to take out Assad and make the same terrible mistake that we made in Iraq, and the same mistake that they made, yes, Democrats, Hillary and Obama, made in Libya, which certainly was handled a hell of a lot better, more honestly, with competence, but was nonetheless still a stupid move geopolitically because we created another power vacuum. And why? I mean, it doesn't mean I don't think Assad's a terrible person. I thought Saddam Hussein was a terrible person. I thought Gaddafi was a terrible person. But, you know, you have to actually think about, not you can't think of the, you can't do the John McCain, Lindsey Graham, let's just bomb and not think about what comes afterwards. You have to think about what comes afterwards, or go to war, even worse, not just bomb, but send your troops in. And the point is that even with something, when we're arming people, you know, who would we have been arming? That's what I would like to know. I mean, if it's Syrian rebels, was it Sunni rebels against the Shia in power, so that then maybe those Sunni rebels eventually end up joining with ISIS? I mean, that's the problem here, you know? And so that's why we can't get involved in those kinds of situations when we don't know what the blowback's going to be.
Well, and specifically what you're talking about is this sort of is regime change. I mean, I think listeners of this program remember that I was in favor of the Libyan intervention to the extent that it was going to stop Gaddafi from slaughtering people in Benghazi, as he had promised to do. The Security Council had determined that there was an imminent threat. But the problem is that, and perhaps it was naive of me to think that it would end there, and I certainly am. I think.
Well, I supported you in that too. So I was supportive of. I'm always supportive of protecting civilians. It's when we start trying to change the regime.
It's regime change, and maybe it's impossible for any type of intervention to not lead to regime change in these instances. But here is Bernie Sanders, who gave a speech later in the day, which was billed as his speech to explain democratic socialism, but he also addressed some foreign policy issues. And here is where he reiterates from the debate the other night and expands upon his belief that regime change, a policy of regime change by the United States, never ends well. It seems, and not the least of which for the people who are directly impacted by it. Here is Bernie talking about his opposition to regime change.
It begins with the reflection that the failed policy decisions of the past, rushing to war, regime change in Iraq, or toppling Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran in 1953. Mossadegh was the president. CIA and others got rid of him to protect British petroleum interests. The Shah of Iran came in, a brutal dictator, and he was thrown out by the Islamic Revolution, and that is where we are in Iran today. Decisions have consequences, often unintended consequences. So whether it was Saddam Hussein or Mossadegh or Guatemalan President Albenz in 1954 in Guatemala, Brazilian President Goulart in 1964, Chilean President Allende in 1973, this type of regime change, this type of overthrowing governments we may not like, often does not work, often makes a bad and difficult decision even worse. These are lessons we must learn.
I mean, I don't know, Cliff, and you might know better than I. I mean, have we ever had a serious contender for president? I mean, this guy's number two in the Democratic race right now. And if I had to bet any amount of money, I would say that the Democrat is going to win the presidency. And by all measures, Bernie Sanders is about as serious a candidate as you can get. Who has actually got up in front of the American public and just given that, even, you know, that 90 seconds worth of history lesson, like, hey, here's six leaders that we just got rid of because we didn't like, more often than not, it was because of business interests. I mean, that me is just stunning.
It is. And you know, we did a lot of that in the 50s and 60s. He even left out some of the shameful things we did in Africa, other parts of the world. Certainly, there could be a whole chapter on Castro and the goings-on there. It is important, because the thing is that, you know, they've mostly wanted to keep that quiet, and you can't learn from history if you don't know what happened, can you? So I think that's incredibly important for, you know, to have, and it's also incredibly important because, you know, this has been a debate on listservs and whatever, you know, which is what is a strong, in the face of terror and things like this, what is a strong democratic, you know, foreign policy look like? And I don't think we've really had a strong, coherent sort of message that clearly lays out what a democratic foreign policy is, you know, for the better part of 30 or 40 years. I mean, we know some of what it means. And I think that you know, maybe that can start to be the underpinnings, because if you just say, if your response is just, we can't do that because it's wrong, that, you know, responding to al-Qaeda by attacking, you know, Iraq is wrong and immoral, and you leave it at that, then that's not a policy. Right. If your policy goes a step further and says, actually, by attacking Iraq, we are creating more of the very terrorists that are going to then come and try and attack us again, as they have. So the foreign policy response is absolutely not to go to war in Iraq. It is to get together, as we are now in light of the terrible attack in France, to unite with our allies and unite with people really throughout the world. You know, and I know that can sometimes mean that we're going to have to join up with some bad people, and that's not a good thing. It's not something I like doing. But there should be, an all-around foreign policy that takes into account not a region or something like that, but looks at the entire world. As people probably know, there was an attack at a hotel in Mali today.
Right.
You know, I mean, what happened in France and what's happened in Mali and what happened in Beirut and whatever, we need something, and it's right there. I mean, having a smart foreign policy that, you know, that avoids war whenever we can, that uses special forces when we have to, that unites through coalitions from NATO to the African Union and others, and works with people to try to, you know, preventing genocide. I mean, we've got a potential Rwanda situation going on in Burundi, and most people don't even know it.
Right.
And we may watch this happen again. You know, where the hell are we on that? There's civilians there. This is not a civil war. These are the government there wants to eradicate civilians because they disagree with them. And so that's what my problem is, and that's what I wish. I think Bernie had given some of the underpinnings of that, but I really would love to see a more expansive view that works all this in together to talk about why it is much better and smarter and will keep you safe, at least a much better chance to keep you safe, if you elect a Democrat with a progressive foreign policy.
Yeah, I mean, let's face it. I think there is a very wide gulf, it seems to me, between what Bernie's perspective is and Hillary Clinton's perspective is on that foreign policy measure. I mean, just when the idea that the predicate for where we are moving forward is actually our past, is the parts of the past. And look, and there's a flip side to that coin too, right? We've taken out however many of these governments over the years, in the 50s, in the 60s, in the 70s. In addition to obviously sort of maybe helping some governments exit on some level, but we've also propped up governments, right, that are that create a sort of a tension, right, a tension of instability. But and I frankly I'm surprised at how little commentary we've seen. And, you know, and part of it is, you know, the context of this week is just very crazy. We've seen very little context of, like, you know, I'm surprised we haven't heard anybody say, I mean, this cuts both ways, to be honest with you. But I'm surprised we haven't heard anybody say, like, wow, Bernie just talked about, Iran and Iraq and, you know, Chile and wow, you know, the last guy to do that nationally was Billy Bragg or something. I mean, you know,
I mean, we need to give context to all of that. And I think Bernie Sanders started to do that. But that's how you also have an affirmative foreign policy, not just a, we don't want to go to war,
right,
and not explaining why, and not explaining how that's smarter, and not explaining the ways through various methods that we will work hard to undermine those that would wish to do us harm, that will attack, that do want to undermine democracies. And do, you know, I mean, this is all incredibly important. And I think the most honest thing we could tell people right away is take morality out of it for a second, you know, and understand that when
pragmatically.
You right, just in terms of pragmatics, right, or that's not a word, but just in terms of being pragmatic about it, you know, the only time I can think of, you know, in recent history when we have gone and have taken out a regime and we have gone and we've occupied and have eventually successfully brought around a democracy are the cases of Japan and Western Germany that became eventually Germany. And there's a reason for that. That is because we stayed there. We committed troops. They weren't even allowed to have a military, so that we were their military. We committed billions upon billions of dollars. We were willing to trade with them and give them all sorts of discounts. We rebuilt their economies. We rebuilt their social institutions that are democratic in nature and promote democracy. So if we're going to be, and these were, you know, certainly in the case of Germany, a culture more similar to our own. So we need to, at the very least, be honest with people, because Republicans are obviously the kings of selling the easy solution. You know, you don't want to stop, you want to stop all abortions? Ban it, right? I mean, that'll just take care of it, right? I mean, this is what they do. You want to solve economic, you know, malaise, economic problems, even if there aren't any, but or aren't significant ones? Cut taxes, solved. And their whole thing is just take out the dictator, done, right? As opposed to explaining to people that, you know, beyond the morality of it, if you decide that you want to take out a government, if you want that place not to become a haven for terrorists, if you want that to actually create a democracy, then be ready to stay there for 75 years.
Right.
You know, or 50 years. And be ready to take our tax money and build schools and build moderate, you know, religious institutions and build think tanks and, you know, provide jobs and do all the things you need to do to win over a local culture, as opposed to, let's just say, kicking all of Saddam's guys out of the government like we did and out of their jobs, so half of them are now in ISIS probably, or certainly a large number of them are, and destroying the local institutions and then just ignoring it. Because if you do that, this is the result will be what we've seen with ISIS. And so people can make that choice. At least if we're arguing to people, we have more of a chance of winning support for what our foreign policy is, because we're not trying to sell, you know, the snake oil Republicans are. We're telling them, you better be ready for the long haul and to have your taxes go to this. If you're not, we should not take out their government.
Let's pivot to Bernie's domestic speech, because this was the much touted, anticipated speech where he would explain democratic socialism. And, you know, the timing of the speech, again, a tough week. But I think, you know, and I think I went back and forth with a listener on Twitter about this a little bit. You know, very difficult in terms of when to give this speech, right? Because leading up into September, he was getting a lot of earned media. I think from their perspective, they're thinking, okay, we're going to get some attention at the debates, so we don't want to burn this speech then. And this would have been the speech where everybody goes home at Thanksgiving and talks about, oh, I heard that socialist speak. But it was in the wake of this this attack in France, and I don't know that he could have waited anymore to talk about it. You know, it's not getting the play and the resonance that I think they were hoping for, and certainly I was hoping for, because this is a great conversation to have. But here is I want to play a couple of quotes from this. Some of them are a little bit long, but you know, it's important people hear these. Here is Bernie introducing, and in many respects, it seems to me that Bernie Sanders, in this speech that he gave, is really arguing that he is more of a Rooseveltian, I guess, Democrat than anything else, which maybe, you know, the the mile markers have shifted such in American politics that now you're a democratic socialist. But, you know, maybe that's what they were at that time. They just didn't use those words.
Right.
Or a social democrat, I should say. So here is Bernie introducing the crowd to FDR's speech, which he gave. And I think we play it on, I think, Labor Day about the Four Freedoms. And here is Bernie introducing the audience to that speech by FDR.
Now, in 1944, in his State of the Union speech, President Roosevelt outlined what he called a second Bill of Rights. You're all familiar with our Bill of Rights. And what Roosevelt outlined was what he called a second Bill of Rights. This is, in my view, one of the more important speeches ever made by a president. But unfortunately, it has not gotten the attention that it deserves. So I'm going to give it some attention today. In his remarkable speech, this is what Roosevelt stated, and I quote, "We have come to a clear realization of the fact that true individual freedom cannot exist without economic security and independence. Necessitous men," and we would add women, "are not free men and women," end of quote. In other words, real freedom must include economic security. That was Roosevelt's vision 70 years ago. It is my vision today. It is a vision that we have not yet achieved, and it is time that we did.
So there you have it, Cliff. I mean, that's an argument that we make on this program quite a bit, too, particularly when we hear from libertarians who call in talking about how much they love freedom and how much they love liberty. The definition of freedom to someone like FDR, to Bernie Sanders, is actually enabling citizens to pursue what they want to pursue without having to feel like they can't feed their kids or they can't get health care or they don't have a place to sleep. And
freedom from starvation, you know, as opposed to the libertarian definition, which would be freedom to starve.
Indeed.
So it's kind of, you know, it's all, and we've allowed the right, I mean, libertarians particularly, but the right in general to kind of completely run away with the terms freedom and liberty and apply them to everything they say, where quite often, you know, it could go either way. And more often than that, there's no justification for their being able to use those terms. So it would be good if we were to get back to explaining what we really believe, you know. And I think what Bernie Sanders did is very smart, because he's putting himself in the tradition, obviously, of one of our greatest presidents, and certainly I think many people would say the greatest Democratic president, and a tradition that, you're right, which is when FDR shifted the culture of what was allowed immeasurably from the 20s, which was a period of a bit of sort of, you know, where of stagnation after some progressive reforms in the 19-teens and the rest, and he moved what was acceptable and what was expected, and starting, you know, in the 70s, but then with Reagan, it was moved back. So that, yeah, we're calling him a social democrat, but a lot of what he stands for are very similar things to what FDR was fighting for and pushing for. So it's a good tradition to be in.
And we should be clear, too, that, you know, FDR, to the extent that FDR was fighting and pushing for things, he was being pushed. I mean, there was the out in front of these reforms in terms of popular demands for things like Social Security and things like in responses to the Great Depression were full-on socialists who were coming from a genuine socialist tradition, having come from Europe. And frankly, also, there was a very strong communist contingency in this country. And we don't simply have those sort of like political movements in this country anymore. I mean, they don't really exist in the way that they existed at that time. So, you know, there's a There's a different sort of dynamic going on here, because in some ways FDR was amplifying, echoing, and responding to what the pressures were on his administration and in the country. He was responding to what he was hearing. He was sort of mirroring back what the broadly speaking, there was a broad popular sentiment. In some respects, you know, what Bernie Sanders is doing is trying to coalesce and make coherent a plethora of complaints and of alienations and disaffections that are out there in our society today, and sort of trying to sort of corral them and put them into some type of coherent, proactive program. And so it's a different dynamic that's going on here, and it's fascinating to watch. And, you know, it's encouraging insofar as there has not been the knee-jerk dismissiveness that I think many people anticipated upon what Bernie Sanders is saying. And part of that is because he's been able, not just him, but to pull Hillary Clinton to the left. And so the gulf there is not quite as large. I mean, it's larger, I think, than the rhetoric from Clinton would lead us to believe. But at least it doesn't sound as large. Here he is talking about Medicare for All.
Well,
I'll say overall, just quickly, that the
party overall is moving vastly in a more populist direction. I mean, really a leftward direction in general, because socially moving in a leftward direction too, but economically. And I think, you know, he's sensing, you know, something that FDR certainly, they're just the times are becoming right. There's many more voices out there on the left, the way you'd have, you know, you had Hugh Long and people pushing on the populist left. I'm not making an exact comparison. I'm just saying, besides him, he's not the only voice out there. You've got Elizabeth Warren, who's created a huge stir with things that she said, and you've got people like Sherrod Brown and others. So it's created a lot of movement, and I think he can you know, join with that as he is and perhaps push some things even further.
Here is his pitch for Medicare for All, and then I know you've got to get going, but let's listen to Bernie basically explain Medicare for All. I mean, look, and the bottom line is, and we don't have time to talk about it now, we will in the coming days. Hillary Clinton has been attacking the idea of raising taxes on everybody. And yes, if we're going to get Medicare for All, if we're going to get a single payer health insurance, we're going to have to pay more in taxes. But at the end of the day, we're going to have more money in our pocket, and we're going to have better health care because we're not going to be paying the private insurance company. Here is Bernie expressing that logic. This is number three.
A Medicare for All single payer program, which I support, would not only guarantee health care for all people, not only save middle class families and our entire nation significant sums of money, because all of you should know that our health care system is by far the most expensive per capita of any system on earth, but a Medicare for All single payer program would radically improve the lives of all Americans and bring about significant improvements in our economy. Think about it. People who get sick will not have to worry about paying a deductible or making a copayment. Radical idea. When they're sick, they can actually go to the doctor and not end up in the emergency room at a much greater expense to the system. Think about it. Business owners will not have to spend enormous amounts of time worrying about how they're going to provide health care for their employees. Think about it, and we don't talk about this very much. You got millions of workers in this country who are staying on jobs, in jobs, which they do not want to stay in, but they're there because they have a decent health care program for themselves and their families. Think what it means when young people or anybody else can say, you know what? This is the job that I love. This is what I want to do. and I'm going to go out and start this business or do this work. And I don't have to worry about health care because all of us in America have health care.
And again, that just simply builds on that notion of what freedom is, right?
Right.
Freedom from, at the very least, certain needs. And that really is like the evolution of human beings, it seems to me. That's why you create societies.
It also offers an important and compelling alternative to the kind of garbage that is not statistically proven or accurate that we hear constantly from, you know, the likes of the Chamber of Commerce. You know, and that's what's so important about it, too, or from even worse Tea Party Republicans that don't want to spend on anything. But the fact that if you like what you're doing, your productivity will inevitably be higher. If you're somebody with that creative idea that's going to create jobs and is going to innovate, but you're stuck at a job because you need health care and it's there and you can't go somewhere else, that limits what we do. That limits our productivity. It limits our innovation. And these are the kinds of arguments that we need out there to take on the BS the other side is slinging. So
right.
It's great in that way, too.
And I mean, you know, people should just contemplate this, right? I mean, the evolution of human beings and the way they organize. We organize into societies, and the libertarians and the conservatives will have you believe, well, the only reason why we organize into societies is to fight wars. And then to just uphold property rights, so to protect yourself and your family from bad guys. But why can't we organize? And, of course, they would never argue we shouldn't organize to prevent or to help each other from natural disasters, right? I mean, that is okay, too. Well, what about things like that are somewhere in between a natural disaster and, warring armies?
Yes.
What about things like illness, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
we would argue it's part of the Lockean social contract.
I mean, that's why you organize into societies is to get
our betterment for our
to
improvement,
secure yourselves
for our
exactly
for our yep.
And
that's certainly my belief. So.
Well, Cliffy, I appreciate you coming on. I don't think we're going to be doing a show next week. And if we are, it's just going to be, I think we're probably just going to do something for members. So,
well, you'll probably be hungover from Thanksgiving anyhow.
Oh, so. Indeed. But I want to wish you a happy Thanksgiving. One of the things that I know that I am thankful for, and I think many people are, is that you come on the program just about every Friday. So,
well, I am thankful
thank
for
you,
the
Cliff.
Opportunity to come on here and that you give me, and thankful to everybody who listens and enjoys it, because I really appreciate that. So thanks.
All right, buddy. Safe travels and have fun next week.
Okay, you too. Take care, buddy.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. We are going to move into that section of the show wherein we play a song by Jimmy Reefer Cake, and then we come back with our film reviewer, recommender of the week. And this week it's going to be Isabel Gillies. But first, Matt, new Matt. We're thankful for you as well, new Matt. And you too. New Kelly, classic Kelly. And you, Michael, old Michael. Old Michael. Matt, what is the name of this week's Jimmy Reefer Cake song? And well, I should say we're thankful for Jimmy Reefer Cake.
This mic isn't working very well. Hold on 1 second. It's seriously, this is spelled SYRIOUSLY.
So it's a Syrian refugee. Okay. All right. So let's play that song. Here it is, Seriously by Jimmy Reefer Cake.
Seriously, Syrians? Not in my state.
Republican governors all agree this is the war on terror. Compassion for these refugees would be a fatal error. Gotta fight the war on terror. What would Jesus do, I ask? But they do not answer. The stupidity is spreading like a frigging cancer. Jeb Bush reminds us that some Syrians are in fact Christians. Never mind, the law of the land is freedom of religion. Freedom of religion. Freedom of religion.
Seriously Syrian
refugees. Talk about seriously Syrian refugees. Syrian refugees. Seriously.
Yes, Jimmy Reefer Cake. Once again, totally on top of the news this week. I'm not sure I know the literal statement there that was being made, but metaphorically and broadly speaking, I think I agree. Now, ladies and gentlemen, not only did Jimmy Reefer Cake do a song of the week for us, but of course, he also did this really famous. I'm going to speak slowly so that Matt can get it together. New Matt, still new.
Each new week, Matt?
New, yeah.
New Matt?
Hold on. You're not supposed to be there yet. Hold on. So that new Matt can get it together. This is a little bit difficult because this is the first time new Matt has had to do this, but it's also not the best way to make a first impression on our next guest.
New Matt.
Yeah, people get very sensitive about this stuff. All right, let me do it. I got it. I got it on my 360. All right, here it is. She won't be able to hear it, but here it is.
Today is Casual Friday. Let us welcome Isabel Gillies to the show. She's going to recommend a movie or two to watch on Netflix. It's the only way I know.
Listen to the picks from Isabel.
IsabelGillies.com.
Man, I'll tell you, that is just one of the many guest theme songs that Jimmy Reefer Cake hit out of the park. Isabel Gillies, how are you?
I'm so good. I'll even say that that's one of my favorite songs.
Period. Well,
period.
Now, to be fair,
even if it wasn't about me.
Andy Krupp, back in the day when we were looking for theme songs, also offered one. Here is that one. Let's play that one, too.
Oh.
The beautiful Isabel Gillies is gonna take us to the movies. She'll tell Sam what's good on the streaming video. So let's go and see what she's chosen.
That I did enjoy the part. Now, nobody in the office, I think, was around when that was in play. That was when we used to have Chris Rosen on the program, who's now at Huffington Post, as our movie reviewer, until I found out that he was not an actual movie reviewer. And so somebody put in the F-U Chris Rosen at the end of that song. But still a very beautiful song.
It's very beautiful. It's very moving, that song. He fills his voice with meaning.
Yeah, well, Isabel, it's got to feel really good to have all these theme songs written about you.
It does.
Now,
I gotta say, it does. So,
all right. So, my understanding is that you are writing a piece. Who are you writing the piece for right now? I think everybody knows you're a best-selling author and an accomplished actress.
I can't tell.
You can't tell who you're writing it for?
No.
Can you tell us what you're writing it about?
No.
Oh, come on, Isabel. Of course you can.
No, because I'm pitching it.
What do you mean you're pitching it?
I'm pitching the idea. They didn't say yes yet. I'm just pitching it.
Well, I mean, don't you want some feedback? You want to see if it's a good idea?
No one will think it's a good idea.
I can assure you that people will. I think it's, I mean, I'm interested in it. It's not even, I mean, it's, well, no, it directly.
It will happen to you indirectly.
Indeed. Of course it will. You're not going to tell me?
I'll tell you. I'm writing about menopause.
Well, there you go, ladies and gentlemen. Kelly just said, oh, my God.
See, how many people, this is my question, how many people across the great nation just cringed or turned off their radio? Probably a lot, because people don't like the topic.
What are you talking about? Who doesn't like the topic?
Most people are pretty grossed out by menopause.
Oh, hold on for a second. Kelly wants to get on the, new Kelly wants to get on the...
I mean...
New if Kelly?
Hi.
Hi.
Are you, were you Stabler's wife on?
Yeah, I sure was.
I just discovered this, and I just really enjoy your work.
That's
part of it.
That's not why you
it.
Took the job?
This, yes. Oh no, you're Wait. So pretty. I that's like my favorite show. I'm starstruck.
Wow.
Oh my goodness,
I want to tell you something.
You.
What happened, Isabel? Kelly said she, in the middle of whatever
I
we were talking about,
that.
She goes, oh my God. And I was like, what happened? Was there another attack? And I am turned. I'm like, what? What is it? Like thinking like, oh, we've got to evacuate the building. And no, it turns out she found out that you were on Law & Order SVU.
As a regular and a good one. And
for 12 years.
For 12 years.
I'm so excited. And
she's crying now. Kelly's crying. Isabel, we have new producers in studio now. Kelly is joining us and new Matt. Just like the old Matt, but significantly taller and knows how to edit on Audacity when he showed up.
Hi, Isabel.
Well, here's my question for you, new Matt. Do you drink soda?
I do drink a lot of soda.
I've
cut back, though, since I've been
now.
Here.
He's cut back. But ask him how many books he's read this year.
How many books have you read?
I've read about 150.
Now, he has a special way of reading. He speeds up audio tracks and follows the book along in print.
But that's interesting. That's auditory learning.
Yes.
My son does that.
Oh, really?
But he doesn't speed up the book, but he reads and he listens and reads at the same time because it gets in better.
Yep, that's how I started too. Just got to tell him to speed it up a little bit and he'll be flying through books.
Oh my gosh, that's so interesting. In fact, one time I was listening to something and it was so fast, I was like, what are these people really crazy talking? And then someone told me that on your iPhone there are different speeds.
Yes,
God,
that's true.
So I slowed
well,
it down.
You're a little bit older than middle-aged. I mean, if that's, if you're just finding that out now, I mean, you're...
She is, she
I
is
am not.
Not.
I'm solidly middle-aged.
No, I know how young Isabel is in real life. I'm just saying, like, mentally. She still doesn't know how to listen to our show.
Well, you know what's really crazy is I'm trying to tweet right now something about New Kelly, and I can't even find where the heck I put it in. I can't even... What's happening?
We got to put it in.
Oh,
you got to do it on
today?
The phone.
Please figure it out.
You're going to make Kelly's
Twitter
day.
Change?
No, Twitter didn't.
In 1 hour?
No.
The hell? Oh, I was on notifications. Okay, all right. What's
this
happening?
Is like literally the conversation I had with my dad last night where I have to like Skype his...
It's at Kelly Carey. That is my handle. And
Kelly's crying now. Like, she's so literally... She's literally like tearing up.
I'm just going to do a new hashtag for you. New Kelly.
Yeah. I'm one follower away from 200 followers, which is exceptional for me. But also, I want
to
just say something really quickly.
Yeah.
I was avoiding getting more for a while there. I want to say something really quickly about your topic for your piece or your book. I'm not sure what you
said. Menopause.
Right. Too bad that people are grossed out about it because over 50% of the population has to deal with it and that it personally, and then a lot of other people do too.
Tangentially, you're
Thank
saying.
You,
tangentially.
Kelly. And I will say, because I'm 45, but I went through menopause. I'm postmenopausal.
Oh, wow.
So I had a weird thing happen, like lightning striking, and went through menopause 15 years early. And now that I'm through with it, I honestly thought, truly, that I had lost my mind. I thought I had gone crazy. I thought.
How long did that last? Wait a second. How long did that last?
For like 5 years.
Oh my God.
It was awful. It was awful. And because no one talks about it, and because certainly no one talks about it to a 37-year-old, I thought, I was so angry and sad all the time and like wanting to sort of sink down into the Hudson River. Not like suicidal, just like I was so thrown off my game. I also had tiny children. It was just this bizarre thing. And now that it's over, and it really is over, I feel back to myself and I started this thing called, remember that anger blog I had?
Yes, I do.
Lose the Temper?
Yes, in fact.
I read that now and I'm like, what? How could I even, I don't even understand how to get that angry now.
We would have you on and we would see if like I could get you angry just to see if like we could break your streak. And it was still very difficult.
Well, people really should talk about it, and you have an interesting angle and an unfortunate experience, but I'm lucky enough that my mom's going to kill me, but that she has told me about her experience.
But that is being lucky.
Yeah,
no,
it is.
Stop. It is being lucky.
It is very lucky.
You'll be prepared for it, and then your husband or wife or whoever will be your, the people in your life will be prepared for it, because honestly, it was like I was a completely different person.
Right. Who, no, your mental status changing, it should.
Well, let me ask you this. So, I have a question, because I want to do a little armchair diagnosis here. What is the first signs of going through menopause?
Well, perimenopause is no joke either, and it takes a long time. So it takes sort
Wait,
of
what?
10
Wait,
years.
What did you say? Pairing?
Peri, P-E-R-I menopause, which means the before menopause. So your body starts, what happens is when you get your period, when you're 12, 13-year-old girl, you know, right at first, is that
oh, gross.
Your body ramps up. And you get your period, and then it's strong and all that stuff in the beginning, and then it kind of chills out for a while, and then the cycle starts to go the other way, and you become kind of like that same 13-year-old girl again with, like, heavy periods and mood swings because your hormones are changing.
Oh, my God. So it's conceivable I could have multiple of those in my house, you're saying.
No, you could definitely have someone getting their period and going through perimenopause or menopause at the same time. And then God help you. No, but it's...
I've got to get on that Ted Cruz prayer team immediately.
Yeah, this started happening to me, and I thought, okay, I've lost my mind. And then when it was over, I felt so much better. I was like, oh, I've got to write about this. But then I wanted to write a whole book about it.
Yeah?
But then my agent said that that's not such a good idea.
Why?
Because it's too marginalized, maybe.
Too marginalized?
Yeah, I don't know. So now I'm writing, I'm going to try and pitch it to this is just today, to this person that I think will like it.
Wow, too marginalized. That seems sort of. I don't know if I buy that. That seems right up the alley. I mean, it's not like you're going to make it a, like a clinical type of thing. I mean, and as long as you just try and sell it in bookstores that are sort of, separated from society, like where you're out in the woods, right?
Don't you? Definition for menopause on Urban Dictionary.
No definition for menopause in the Urban Dictionary.
Yeah, we have no definition yet. Do you?
Wait, in the Urban Dictionary? What about like the
Urban
Oxford
Dictionary? So if you Google, so if you're trying to be hip and cool about menopause,
yeah.
You can't be because I mean, there's. I was trying to think of a cool way to say menopause, and sort of like the kids are.
Oh,
saying
I already know what it is.
What?
I already know what it is. In fact, I think John Benjamin and I, when we were in college, we did some comedy bit about this. It's woe menopause.
Whoa, like W-H-A-O?
That's right. That's right. Whoa, menopause. Like, whoa, menopause.
Wait a minute. That's the funniest thing I've ever heard, and I'm going to call my
Seriously?
That.
Wow. All right.
Whoa,
great.
Menopause.
There you go.
Do you see? But you were talking about menopause with John Benjamin back in college?
Is that honestly the funniest thing you've ever heard?
No, but it's one of them. Well, it's very applicable to my life at this moment because menopause is hard for me even to write it.
Yeah, I mean that's what, and apparently that's what your agent said. Whoa, menopause? Don't write about
Whoa.
That.
menopause. No. Yeah.
Right?
No.
See how that works?
No, he wasn't saying that I couldn't write about it. He was just like, wow. Okay. And there is like one other book about it.
That's There's only been one other book?
Funny.
Really?
No, there's a lot of books about it with some sort of, you know, like,
this is how you deal with it.
Very,
this is how you deal.
Yeah. Right. How you deal with it. It's not like it's fun. Nothing about it is fun. And you lose your sex drive and all this stuff. But there's things that you can do. So it's good to talk about.
Now, you're not
it,
conflating this with marriage, are you?
No, I was in a new marriage.
Well, all right.
All I wanted to do was have sex. And then suddenly I was like, what? And I couldn't understand it because there was no reason to fight, no reason not to be having sex all the time. And then it all went south and I couldn't figure it out.
Well, there you go. All right.
But it was menopause.
And so are you, but you are still writing a book now, right? Are you doing that simultaneously? You're writing another tweener? Hey, Mila could be ready for your first tween book, right? Or is she still a little young?
It's true. It's out in paperback, by the way.
It is.
How old is
it?
She?
What is it? Like, it's, don't tell me the name of it. It's Starry Night.
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah. Did you just do a quick Google?
No, I did not. That was off the top of my head.
Wow.
Yeah,
you're not menopausal.
Now, is she ready to read that book as a 10-year-old? Or
How old is she? No. 10, a little too young.
Yeah, well, I'm not
12
convinced.
12 is good.
All right.
12 is good.
Well, she's 10 going on like 43.
Has she seen Hunger Games and stuff?
She is. She wants to, and she's yet to see that. I made her watch Star Wars first. That was basically the deal I said. Like, you got to get some type of... I can't even believe that, like, Star Wars is, like, some type of, like, movie history. But, you know, for her, I mean, the thing happened.
It is.
I mean, when did the first Star Wars come out? In the 70s? I mean,
76 or something.
I mean, when I was her age, the comparable movie would have been, like, some Charlie Chaplin movie.
Yes.
Maybe, that would have been later, right? Because he came out, what's that one about the dictator? Well, the dictator probably came out probably like 1939. And when I was Mila's age, 40 years earlier, would have been 1936. So it hadn't even come out yet. I mean, so that's how, when I like think about stuff like that, that drives
me
crazy.
Have you seen Star Wars lately?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. Well, actually,
I mean, it doesn't look like the movies today.
Well, yeah, but I mean, if you go to the New Hope, that he redigitized those and it doesn't look quite as sophisticated, but nevertheless, I mean,
my brother walked around like Han Solo, all, you know, dressed up for years, for the whole 70s.
But that was because your folks made him, right? They made him do that.
And I was Chewbacca.
Did you? Really? No.
No.
All right.
No. I wasn't even.
So, Isabel, what else is going on? Now, let me just say this. I'm just going to drop this in here. Isabel and I have been talking about doing another podcast together. And it's just. You got to. We're still working on Isabel's vocal control, but
so
and we have yet to piece it together. And largely that's because of your fault, Isabel.
Yes.
But and it's going to be sort of vaguely an advice show. So if you have any questions that we can answer for you or really find anything out for you.
Tell the name of the podcast. Tell the name.
How can we help you? That will be the name of the podcast. Yep. How can we help you? Which, of course, is a double entendre, right? Like, how can we help you, and how can we help you? So, if you have any questions or you need anything resolved, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com, and just put in the subject line Isabel, and that way I'll be able to pull them out, and we'll do our best to answer your question.
And it can be any question because what we're going to do is we're going to have we'll think about it and think how we would handle it, but then we will also pull from our collective.
You have access to a lot of experts. I have access to.
Yeah.
I have a very limited array of experts. But you, I mean, you're more of
a
socialite, bon vivant, and
doctors, lawyers, business people,
yeah.
And then also
I don't know anybody like that.
I don't know. I know a lot of people.
I know one lawyer, and he's bankruptcies. I got down. That's basically it. Bankruptcy's
political
down.
People, you never know. If you have a big question, maybe we might even get a big star to come in and weigh in on it.
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, we got a million different ways to do it. So send us an email. So, all right. So, what else, Isabel? Quickly, what else are you working on? I mean, come on.
Well, there's the high school thing. The high school thing continues,
right,
getting the kid into high school,
right,
which is actually proving to be a political thing that we could talk about another time. But so if you think about the me, middle-aged, white, affluent sort of person, educated.
Not sort of,
certainly.
But okay. I mean, look, you were, you were a TV star for 15 years. I mean, come
on. Yeah. Okay. So, but if you think about the resources I have and the energy to put towards this that I have, and I can barely get through it. And this is in New York City, I'll say, because in New York City, you really...
I'm going through this in Brooklyn right now with middle school.
Right, exactly. You have to apply to public school. That's the point. The point is you have to apply to go to public school. So it is so difficult and so hard to navigate that even so if, let's say you had two jobs. Let's say you were, let's say you didn't have all of my resources. What would you do? Because you can't, because the schools that you can just walk right into are just, I'm sorry, they're not good. And it's the government's fault or it's somebody's fault. Why there's not enough money is a problem. It's like, I know that, and we've said it a million times, but it really is a problem.
Yeah, no, I agree.
I mean,
but this is something we could even talk about on how can
on
we
my
help you.
Plate.
Right. I mean, there's
and who's going to deal with it? Who's going to deal with it?
Well,
who? Billionaires?
I mean, that's, you know, there's a lot of these schools. It's sort of interesting when you go around. Is like, there's a middle school. I'm not going to say the name of the school, but there's a middle school we looked at where they actually replaced teachers with computers. And as soon as I hear that, Nikki had come back from the tour, and I said, "Oh, and did they brag about how much money they're getting from Bill Gates or Apple?" And that's exactly what it is. Like, they, to get money, they basically sell their school to a technology company that ultimately that is in the business of making technology. And so they get these huge grants, which allow them to roll in these technology. I don't know if the administrators actually buy it, this is like a great thing, or they just know, like, this is the way that we get to the top. And we've been chosen as one of the, you know, Microsoft learning schools of the country. Out of like 5,000 schools that applied, we got in there, and now all our kids, we have no teachers. They just, they literally go on a computer.
iPads.
Yep.
That's what happened in our school. Everyone had an iPad, and you know what I said? iPads are toys.
Well,
excuse me, like, what's happening?
There's valuable things to be learned from them, but they can't replace teachers. It's ludicrous.
No, they cannot.
All right, so Isabel, with all this said, we have certainly set the table.
That's on my plate.
Okay. And
so wait,
what?
I'll just because I'm introducing what I'm going to say.
Okay.
My recommendation. And so with the high school, there's a lot of stress. And there's stress in the country, right? Because everybody's worried in Paris and ISIS. And it's a high stress time, I think.
Well, and Thanksgiving's coming up. That's also stressful. I know.
Thanksgiving, holidays. It's a bit tense. And so
Are you making Thanksgiving at your house? You're going to have to tell us about next time. All right, next time. Okay.
That's
separate story.
Makes me okay. I'll put that online somehow. I'll do my menu. Okay. So listen, a little tense, a little stressed, and it's hard for me to fall asleep at night.
Right.
So I was looking for something on Netflix, and I came across something that is the biggest, has the most audience in Britain. It's the biggest audience in Britain. I think it's 39 million people.
Wow.
How many? Can you Google someone how many people live in Britain?
I think it's 39.6 million. No, I don't
is
know.
It?
But no. But what is
but,
the show?
No,
so what
is
it? It's big. I don't know. I don't know how many people live in Britain.
No one does?
Well, nobody.
New Kelly?
It's 64.1 million.
Okay. Thank you. Is that new Matt? Thank you, New Matt. So listen, 39 million people watch this show. There's only 69 people, right, in Britain. So that's
almost
a ton of people
right.
watching this show. And it has provided me with joy, happiness, calm feelings, tranquility, warmth. Okay, ready?
Yeah.
It is called, and I'm not kidding, The Great British Baking Show. It's on Netflix. It is a baking reality show, cooking show, like a what's it called? a game show.
Yeah.
And it is the best thing that I've seen in years. It
the
is
great
the
British
funniest
baking show.
You can watch it with Mila. You can watch it with Saul. You can watch it with everybody. And what I don't know what is in that mix, but it has
put you right to sleep.
Soothed me. It's like I see that music comes on. I'm like, oh, hi, friend. How you doing? It's like sitting down with everybody you love, and then it's just 50 minutes of sheer pleasure. And here's the thing: I don't bake. I'm a big cook, so cooking shows kind of give me slight anxiety because I'm like, oh my god, when should I make that? What menu should I do? I wonder if I could saute it longer; it would be better. The caramelization. But baking, I don't bake, and I will never bake anything that they're baking. So I just sit back, relax, and watch the show. You don't have to have any interest in cooking or baking, but something about the formula has hit a chord with everyone in Britain, and I'm telling you. Just watch one episode. It has got warmth to it. The people are so nice. There's no biting competition. Mm. It's competition, but in the most sort of enjoyable way. And I swear, if anybody's feeling anxiety or stress about these terrible things in the world or whatever's going on in your day or your work, tune in. Right there, Netflix, free.
I don't even know what to do if I got rid of all that. What would a day be if I got rid of all that?
I know. I'm telling you. I know I could recommend some fancy movies. I saw Brooklyn, which is fabulous.
The
Great British Baking Show. It's a real recommendation. I really want people to watch it because it is just so soothing. And I think that's what we need a little bit right now in the country.
I edit television recaps, and it is not. I don't think I've ever had somebody submit. It's a sort of a community type of vertical, but I don't think I've had anybody submit a cooking show. And one person does a recap of the show, and they love it. They say the same thing.
Well, there you have it,
New Kelly.
The great.
I'm telling you, please, the Great British Baking Show.
All right, Isabel.
And the woman on it, Mary Berry, who's one of the judges.
Mary Berry?
Mary Berry kind of is like my mother.
Okay.
Just putting it out there. And right. When I was watching it with the kids, they were
now,
like,
now, when you say
so
kind
granny.
Of like my mother, like, do you mean like she reminds you of your mother or like you just sort of perceive her as sort of like your mother? Like, is it getting like a weird thing or is it?
No. It's like an ilk thing. It's like the thing she says, she'll say something like, well, that is quite delicious. Just the way she says things, I'm like, that's kind of like my mother. And then the kids thought that too.
Hmm.
It's like watch it with Mila tonight. I swear, I'm so excited by it. And then tell me if you like it.
Okay, I will, but I won't.
You
watch
will
it with
like
Mila
it.
Tonight. All right.
Yes,
well,
you will.
Okay. All right. Well, it sounds like I might like it.
I think you're gonna love it.
I mean, it's no Homes on Homes, but I will watch it.
Yeah.
Isabel Gillies, it is always a pleasure. Thank you so much. I will talk to you very shortly, like within the next couple hours, I will call you.
I am home. And thank you, New Kelly, New Matt, for your, for being there and supporting Sam.
All right. There's Michael's actually here. You wouldn't know it, he's been, he's been buried in his phone texting.
How are you?
All right, ladies and gentlemen. Okay. Isabel Gillies. Thank you, Isabel.
Bye, guys. Hey, happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you.
Yeah.
Okay.
They make pies on that show. Okay.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
All right. Isabel Gillies, ladies and gentlemen. The wonderful Isabel Gillies. All right. We're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. I'm going to probably have to do a little bit on the short side because I am doing a pre-tape with Charlie Savage. He will be on this program next week. But we're going to pre-tape the interview today because it's easier to do. Sometimes it's tough to get people. All right, folks, don't forget, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. We'll be back live on Monday. And if you're a member, stick around. We've got plenty more. The number is 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. 20.